Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
My name's Catherine Carr, and this is season two of Relatively.
Well, I'm in my book line study, as you requested. So,
the podcast all about potentially the longest relationships of your life.
This week, we're talking to Giles Fraser.
Now, there is a tiny chance, it's 5%, 3%, that my children will wake up.
We call it doing a Jacinda, don't we, now, these days?
Is that... I'm the oldest, but I haven't always been the oldest. Well, even that's not right. Goodness, where do we even start?
In this episode, Giles will be talking about his older brother, Jonathan, who died before Giles was born.
It feels illegitimate to have grief for somebody that you've never met, been alive at the same time as. And yet, I would describe it that way. It's so a part of our family's story, and the pain extends through the generations.
Priest, journalist and broadcaster Giles grew up all over the place, moving house often. The loss of his brother shaped the way his family functioned and even influences Giles's own parenting style. We talk about that, about grief, faith and teenage rebellions. But Giles started by talking about Jonathan and his place in the family.
I had a brother who was born a few years before me, who passed away at 7 months old. He died in what people used to call a cot death. And in fact, even before that, my mum had a stillbirth, little girl called Mary, who lasted a little while. And then before that, had seven miscarriages. So it goes, in terms of my mum's pregnancies, it goes seven miscarriages, Mary, Jonathan, and then me. And then perhaps we'll talk about what comes after me in a minute, because that's a story too. But the family story extends, in terms of siblings, extends considerably before me and after me.
And I wonder what kind of sense you had of that as a child, that you were on a line, a point in a line that went a long way back.
Jonathan was always talked about, and it was still pretty raw, even a few years after he died, when I was born. And I certainly became aware, and more so as I got older, that my parents' parenting style was very much shaped by what happened to Jonathan. I've got a terrible memory, and it's very hard to go back into how you felt as a child, but I think I was aware that there was the presence of another sibling. My mother's pain was pretty evident even when I was quite young. And I think I felt that was unusual. And I certainly felt that we were, well, my brother and I were particularly valued, protected. We were clung on to quite a lot. My dad reacted to it differently, but my mum certainly cried a lot. It still does, actually. The tears are very close to the surface. And in fact, yesterday was the anniversary of Jonathan's death. He'd be 60 next year in April, but he died 59 years ago yesterday. And I phoned my mum up, and she has a little ritual that she does on that day.
And what's that?
Jonathan's ashes were put in a bird bath, which has always stayed in the family garden wherever we've lived. And she'd always put some flowers on the bird bath or sit by the bird bath. I don't know if that's a ritual as such, but the bird bath was the thing that would happen. And my birthday's in a few weeks' time, so it's there's always a sense that Jonathan's death comes first and then my birthday happens.
So if I do the maths, if you'll forgive me, yes. How old does that make you, Giles? I'm terrible at ages and counting.
No, it's fine. Well, I'm quite terrible at this, but at the moment I'm 56 and I will be 57 on November the 27th.
Yeah, well, happy birthday for the end of the month. Then your early childhood would have been 60s then.
Yeah. So right? I was born in 1964. I think Jonathan was born 1962. Would that be right? So there's nearly a couple of years between him dying and me being born.
And I'm wondering, before I want to talk more about how it was kind of explained and how you boys who came after understood what your mum had been through, if indeed you could, until you got to her age yourselves. But I wonder, it's interesting to think about what the attitude was and how people treated that kind of tragedy in the 60s compared to now, whether you have a sense of it getting better. We have a language for it now. You would be called a rainbow baby now. You came after the loss or the death of a child.
Oh, is that what it's called? I didn't know that name.
Yeah.
Is that what it's called? A rainbow baby?
You would be a rainbow baby now. But, and we have a place for, you know, we have a sort of place for those people to take their grief. There's sometimes special services and stuff. But I'm imagining in the 60s, that was less of the case.
Yeah, my mum talks quite a lot about how people reacted to her, how they were very frightened of her pain. She recalls one event that happened in the supermarket when she saw someone who was, I don't know, friend stroke acquaintance. Mm-hmm. And the acquaintance thought my mother hadn't seen her and decided not to go down the same aisle because I suspect, and my mum suspects, she didn't know what to say. She was too afraid of my mum's pain. And funnily enough, I'm a priest, and I mean, other people's pain is sort of my stock in trade, in a way. And I've always learned, I think, through what happened with my mum, I've never been quite so afraid of other people's pain. I can bear quite a lot of pain from other people, and I don't find it destroying. And I think pastorally, that's quite a gift. I mean, I'm terrible in other ways pastorally, but that's one way in which I don't think I am terrible. And I'm sure that's related to the fact that I was born when my mum was still in a period of mourning.
And being denied her grief in some ways. If people aren't strong enough to sit with you in it, then it's almost being denied, isn't it? And I think that's really painful.
Yeah. She talks quite a bit about those people who were very helpful and those people who are not. And the church was in the not category. She talks about somebody who came too quickly with answers in those situations. And there's religious versions of that. And there's secular versions of that, you know, time will heal and all those sorts of things that people say.
So let's go back to the 60s for you then, rather than for your mum's experience. And it is heartbreaking to hear that. And I'm really sorry that that was your mum's experience, because that must have been incredibly lonely at certain points. Mm. But as the little boy that came along afterwards, I suppose you can't really remember at what age you became conscious, but how was the life and the death and the missing of Jonathan explain to you? Can you remember right at the beginning?
I mean, this much I know, that it was explained to me well before I could remember it being explained to me, if you understand what I mean. So I think it was explained to me before I had the capacity to even take it in. it begins to dawn on you what's happened. And there were photographs of him and all of that. There were also other things, which was those people who were particularly good during that time. So there was one. So Jonathan died in the night. They woke up. They thought Jonathan was having a lie-in. They went downstairs. They sort of rather appreciated that he was having a lie-in because, you know, kids they didn't
Babies
have much
don't.
Sleep. Yeah. So they went downstairs, perhaps they had a cup of tea, and only later my dad went up and found him. I think that's right. And anyway, they called some family friends and they came round, attended to the body. And that
the
was
friends
a kind
did.
The friends did, as I remember. And they're very, very close family friends. And that was a sort of bonding between our families. I think my dad ran into the street and wouldn't come back. It's hard. These are things you don't talk about very much. And I find myself strangely, well, not strangely. How can it be strangely? But I can feel myself welling up talking to you about it.
Well, there's such raw horror in that moment.
It's horror.
Anybody can imagine. It's sheer horror.
Yeah, no, it's sheer horror. It's sheer horror. And he died before I was born. But it's so a part of our family's story, and the pain extends. It extends through the generations. But in my mum's life, it's something that she just. It's a part of her. It's just sort of built into her. I mean, there was all sorts of consequences for me about it happening. Inevitably, one of the consequences is that I was. Definitely sort of loved to the point of overprotection, almost. I don't know if it's quite claustrophobic, but I was aware of being, this sounds stupid really, but I was aware of being loved stroke overloved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she must have been so fearful. I mean, you must live in...
Terribly fearful. Terribly fearful.
Terribly fearful. And what do you do with that fear if you don't... I mean, the most positive thing you can do is love your child too much.
Exactly right. I'm not... It sounds churlish to complain about that.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it sounds churlish. I just wonder what I would do.
Yeah, well, that's what I do. I mean, I definitely do that. I mean, I wouldn't know how to go on. But and when you become a sort of rebellious teenager... That's an obvious thing to rebel against, you know, that sort of... And I mean, I don't think it takes a particularly adept psychotherapist to work out that some of my rebelliousness is somehow rooted in some of those very early experiences about feeling overly protected, if that's it. But also massively appreciated. Well, it was wonderful to be made to feel so safe and loved.
Yes, but at the same time, at your worst points, I could imagine with your sort of teenage rationality, your lack of rationality, it's like you're being treated in a certain way for a thing that you never even witnessed or understood were responsible for, and yet you're bearing a bit of it somehow, and that must be such a muddly feeling mixed in with actually there's grief, right, for something that is missing, that there should have been and there was an older brother.
Yes, and it's funny to talk about grief in this context because it feels illegitimate to have grief for somebody that you've never met, never been alive at the same time as. And yet I would describe it that way. But it's confusing. I mean, it's confusing to have that pain and also my sort of teenage get off me type of
Well, you can inherit grief, can't you? And there is secondhand trauma. We know about that now. And so
I do think so. Yeah.
Yes, I think there must be. And if you're living in the home with a woman who she lost a son, yes, but she lost 7-8 babies before that. That's, yeah. She was carrying one hell of a lot of pain. And then it's very claustrophobic to be with that pain. And you would have absorbed it somewhere in your, through your skin somewhere, breathed it
certainly.
In.
Yeah, I'm sure I did. And I'm sure it has shaped me in both positive and negative ways. I'm sure that's right. Perhaps that even sounds too functional, really, shaped me. I just, I do feel I carry some of it anyway. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's another consequence. I'm going to just carry the story on a little bit before you ask me the questions, because so I had a couple of years after me, I had an older brother, a younger brother. I think his experience would be similar to mine. And then when I went away to school, when we were teenagers, I had a friend at school whose parents died in very difficult circumstances when he was 13. It's a long story, but in the end, he ran away from the guardians that were appointed for him. And he came and pretty much turned up with us. Mm. In the end, he came and lived with us, and my parents adopted him.
Oh.
And he took the surname Fraser. So I have one biological brother, and I had one adopted brother from 13. And my parents were... we've talked about this quite a lot, about the sense in which my mother lost Jonathan and gained Anthony. Now, that sounds wrong, you put it that way, because it sounds like some sort of replacement, and it's not. But there was certainly a pain of loss in Anthony when he lost his mum in difficult circumstances. And he's certainly become my brother. To the extent that when he pisses me off, he's still my brother, if you know what I mean. you know, I'm pretty sure that if my mum hadn't had that terrible pain with Jonathan, what happened with Anthony probably wouldn't have happened in the same way. So what I want to say is those consequences, you know, up into my teenage years, and, you know, and Anthony and Jonathan have some... I don't know. They both can. I think there's some connection, however difficult it is to describe, in my mother's soul. Yeah.
Well, it just sounds like when you were describing the way that this event that happened before you were born has shaped you, inevitably shaped you, it sounds a little bit like, listening to it, that, you know, your mum's heart was broken, but it was almost broken open. And in the same way it shaped her, like, you, once you've known pain, you can see it in others and respond to it sometimes better. So maybe she just became, I don't know, it just sounds like this, that it matched in some way.
That's a beautiful phrase, broken open. I think that did happen to my mother. I mean, I think you're right that there's ways in which one is available to other people in ways that were sort of like, that experience of great suffering, you know, makes possible. But I also think it probably does damage you as well.
Well, it's trauma, isn't it? It's deep trauma.
That sort of trauma is lifelong. And my mum, you know, my mum's still alive, and my dad's still alive. There's something rather lovely about our ability to talk about him and to have a little cry It's not, you know, we wouldn't talk about him now. We'd talk about him two or three times a year, maybe. But those conversations are very intimate, and yeah.
And I wonder with your family friends whether, you know, they came when he just died and they helped. Mm. It's so intimate that those
amazing
moments of death. And
amazing.
How, you know, he was, they knew him, obviously. They'd cuddled him and had him on their lap, and they knew your mum when she was pregnant. And it to know someone who knew them and to keep them real and to talk about them easily, that's a real gift, isn't it? So even those little conversations you have for your mum must feel like he lived, he was real.
Yeah.
My feelings are valid, all of that, which is so hard with the death of babies and young children, because it is people I'm not sure have made so much progress in the last 40, 50, 60 years.
I always ask my mum all the time, what was he like? What was he like? You know, would it, now it's, you know, he died at 7 months. So it's not that, I don't know quite how you can answer those questions, but she does. He was much gentler. My biological brother and I are quite tough, I suppose. I think we're pretty tough and robust and quite vulgar. You know, I think I've got quite a vulgar soul, really.
You're the priest. You can say it.
Yeah. Well, I just, you know, I'm a bit of a scrapper and so forth. But I think Jonathan was a very gentle spirit. That's what my mum says. And then, of course, the other consequence it has is that it sounds silly, but my eldest daughter was born on the same day, has the same birthday as Jonathan.
Oh.
And now this was a matter of real anxiety for me, you know, in some sort of superstitious way. I was very keen for her to get past the date that Jonathan died when she was a baby. That for me was making sure she was okay. And perhaps it extends to my parenting style as well. You know, one of the things that people used to say about cot death was it was to do with too warm or too cold, all this sort of stuff.
Mm.
And modern technology has been very well used in the phrase a household for our children, because I watch the bloody temperature thing really quite assiduously. And, you know, if it starts to go off, it's too hot. I'm a bit all over that. But I'm sure that's just symptomatic of actually how my emotional parenting style is actually really quite shaped by what happened with Jonathan.
Well, I'm sure it is, because I think what people sometimes say, I was listening to another podcast that was talking about this, when something terrible happens to somebody, often the first phrase that people reach for is, oh, I just can't imagine that. And actually it's completely not true to start with, because of, you can, and you probably have, is what this podcast said. And the second thing is, you're putting somebody in a category apart and being like, well, I can't possibly imagine that. That's just truly horrendous. Off you go. You're over there in a silo of people that I can't think about. But actually, if the worst has happened and your family hasn't had to empathize, sympathize, or imagine it's actually happened and it's affected you on such a profound level, of course you're going to be like that about the temperature, because you're not... You're not like every other parent who hasn't had the direct or indirect influence of that. Just imagining, you know, like, you know,
I have some sympathy with the othering of that sort of pain, even though only because the sort of people, when people say it's unimaginable, I agree with you that people do imagine it. They have nightmares about it. They you know, people know that they fear it. But I do have a sort of, how could you not have a sort of sympathy with people wanting to push that sort of fear away. You know, that's the sort of fear I want to push away as well.
So as a priest who's good pastorally at sitting with people in their pain, that's something that, you know, you've learned to do, or is innate in you, or is somehow has been built into you.
Yeah.
What do you do now when faced with this kind of pain? You must have seen people who've lost children in similar circumstances. Do you think that we've got better at it? Do you think the church would be in the behaved well box these days?
Oh, there's good. I don't know really. You see, what people do, I don't think it's a theological problem. I think what it is that some people, and I think this is religious or not religious, are very disturbed by being in heightened emotional situations where they don't have a quote-unquote answer. And they feel they need to find some sort of words of reassurance. I expect their words to reassure themselves as well, that the universe is a kinder place than it seems today. You know, that's when you can easily go wrong. It's when you reach too quickly for some sort of cheap consolation. Mm. I've never thought of it this way, and you've prompted me to think of it. But one of the things I often say about what I think church is for, and certainly I think my church is for, is it's a place where you come and hold the stuff that you don't know how to cope with or deal with or answer. I think that sums up quite a lot of what I believe, actually. It's very interesting. I used to teach, one thing about this, because how it crosses. So I used to teach philosophy in Oxford. And one of the questions you always have in philosophy is religion is the so-called problem of evil, problem of pain. You know, how does a good God exist and bloody bloody, but we all know that if there's so much pain, misery and suffering in the world. And you know, I sort of get students exploring these questions and coming up with different answers and so forth. And it struck me that there was such a disconnect between, and I was also a priest at the time, between what people said to me at funerals and what the questions they were asking as undergraduates in essays about the problem of suffering, problem of evil. And I think one of the things I'd want to say about pain is that what students didn't quite see is that when people go why, which is quite common, it's more a cry than it is a question. It's more a cry for help. It's more, fucking hell, what's this all about? It's more, rather than a sort of like, how do these pieces all fit together in terms of how the universe works? So, yeah, there's a very odd disconnection between the sort of intellectual interrogation of pain and its emotional, its phenomenological experience.
And my next question was going to be then, as a kind of fully, you know, a grown up now.
Yes.
And somebody who's gone past the age that your mum was when she lost Jonathan, and somebody who has this theological worldview that I'm sure bends and shifts according to your experiences and whatever else informs your faith. How do you look at your brother now, and how do you look at your mum's pain in losing your brother? Do you bring some of that theology to bear in the way that you talk to her about it and the way that you think about him? Because it must have shifted from that little boy that saw the pictures and didn't even know what death was to the man that you are now, who ministers to people who wail at funerals to ask why.
You'd think it would have changed, wouldn't you?
I don't know. I'm asking.
Yeah. No. I know. I'm not so sure that it's changed that much. You know, in a sense, my mother's response to that pain was to hold her children tighter. And I still think, in theological terms, if I had to sort of do it without all my sort of academic-y filters on, it's something about being held by God that feels to me terribly important. I mean, Christianity is one of the world's great religions that really faces pain very directly with the crucifixion and so forth. So this is horror built into the heart of things. But the idea that that love is the ultimate... that the universe is is pregnant with loving purpose, it seems to me, absolutely rock bottom with what I believe. And I suspect that's there in holding my children and being held by my mother. I also want to say something else about Jonathan. I sort of want to say something really odd about Jonathan, but I feel like I love him. You know, I really want to say that I love him. I never met him. And he's certainly my brother, and he's certainly part of the sort of my sense of what my family is about. I rather like his gentle presence amongst his other brothers, who are probably a lot more robust than him. But I don't know if I'm imagining that or not. That's certainly how I feel.
Well, maybe he has his rightful place in the family. Like, it's
he definitely
never going
to
go away.
No, exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, he does have his place in the family. And he's there in the bird bath. And I think when my parents pass away, I think that bird bath will come to me.
Thank you to Giles, and thank you too for listening. Now, I wanted to tell you a word I discovered, which I think might be perfect for now.
Oh, go on, I want to hear it now. Go on.
Yeah. It's a Portuguese word, and I don't know if you know it, you probably do, but it's called saudade. I think that's how you say it.
I don't know it.
It's a longing, a nostalgia, and a loss for something or someone that you may never have known. So they actually have a word for the particular pain and tug, and I thought that was good.
That's a very interesting thing.
For siblings affected in this way, or if you're a parent and you need some resources, you can head to Child Bereavement UK at childbereavementuk.org. They have lots of good stuff. Coming up on Relatively in a little while, but a good time to say it because it's just been Remembrance Sunday, the amazing code-breaking sisters, Pat and Jean Outram, who have almost a century of sibling memories to share. To see some sweet pictures of Giles when he was little, and to see baby and toddler pictures from all of our guests on Relatively Podcast from season 1 and season 2, just head to the website relativelypodcast.com. There's a good tradition of love and hate, staying by the fireside. There's a good tradition of love and hate, staying by the fireside. Now the rain may fall, your father's calling you, you still feel safe inside. Although your ma's too proud, your brother's ignoring you, you still feel safe inside. Oh, was it solo? Was it yesterday? Was it true for you? 'Cause while all the rest had taken time, this didn't do enough for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.